This is the Happiness Quotient. If you're a first-time listener or regular listener of the HQ, please be sure to subscribe wherever you may be listening, whether on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, wherever it may be. And when you subscribe, you'll be notified each time a new episode comes out. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, give me a podcast rating, please, okay? And if you have a chance to leave 5 stars, that would hit the spot, too. About to know how it feels now and then. I got a happiness just my friend. Greetings. Today's interview with Peter Hillary is released in advance of a live Facebook event on the environment of Everest and the waste problem there, taking place on June 30th with the Musa Masala Organization and their support of the Wangchu Memorial Hospital in Nepal. I'll be doing a presentation on the state of the environment of Everest, which will include guests Peter Hillary, Dan Mazur of the Everest Biogas Project, and other notable guests. You don't want to miss it. Check the show notes here for info on where to watch us live or for links to view the program if you're listening after the event. I got a happiness joy. Today, a special guest, Peter Hillary, son of the first man to ever climb Mount Everest, Sir Edmund Hillary, whom I interviewed in 2004. Peter himself has climbed Everest twice. In addition to being an accomplished mountaineer, he is a speaker and he raises funds for Himalayan foundations around the world. Together with his sister, Sarah Hillary, they manage the intellectual property of the Ed Hillary Estate, and I can almost guarantee you that you know someone named after his dad. During a recent conversation, Peter and I talked about the environment of Everest, the current state of Nepal and the Khumbu region, the garbage and growing human waste problem there, how COVID has devastated the country, and what's being done about it. That's right now on the HQ. Before I play the interview, some background is important. Since Sir Edmund Hillary climbed Mount Everest for the first time with his partner Sherpa Tenzing Norgay in 1953, the entire Mount Everest region has blossomed into a tourist trekking and climbing region for travelers and adventurers the world over. It started slowly at first until in 1985, the first guided expedition took place on Mount Everest. American David Brashears guided Texas businessman and rancher ski area owner Dick Bass successfully to the summit. Before trekking and climbing was allowed there, the lives of the Sherpa had remained pretty much unchanged for hundreds of years, living in the beautiful, albeit austere, remote mountain environment, eking by on small farms. And then, with the increasing numbers of trekkers and climbers, tens of thousands visit the Khumbu region every year, the lives of the Sherpa have been transformed, very much for the better. A climbing Sherpa can earn in one season on Everest 10 or more times what he or she might earn by working his farm or by trading. The benefits are obvious, but with more visitors to the fragile environment come more trash, more pressure on local resources such as wood to burn fires to cook food, more human waste, and with no roads or means to remove that said waste. Some have gone so far as to call Everest the highest garbage dump on Earth. Peter grew up climbing mountains and taking in many of his dad's expeditions and projects, traveling to the North Pole, among other places, up the Ganges River in India, climbing in the Himalayas around the United States and helping the mountain people of Nepal, which was his dad's sole focus after he summited in 1953. Peter's first summit of Everest was in 1990. He and his dad became the first family of Himalayan mountaineering, with 2 generations of Everest climbers. He climbed Mount Everest for the second time in 2002 for a National Geographic documentary celebrating his dad's first ascent. I first met Peter in Kathmandu in 2016, where I interviewed him at the Radisson Hotel for a film project I was working on. This conversation with Peter was via video conference where he was at his home in New Zealand. It was June 12th. Where I was, it was June 11th in the United States. Here's our conversation. How are you doing? How's your family? How did everybody do with this COVID thing?
Well, look, it's certainly been a big challenge around the world. New Zealand has followed very much the recommendations of epidemiologists and experts in the field, and the borders were closed. Our borders are closed with the exception of our ability to travel to Australia. Mm. So life very quickly returned to normal. We've had a couple of lockdowns, one at the beginning of the pandemic. And I mean, actually, it's a bit like going back in time because we're doing what everyone used to do before everyone traveled overseas all of the time. Everyone travels around the country. So I and my family have been going to the mountains to walk and ski and climb. And look, in many respects, it's been great. It's hard on some areas of business, of course.
And I know that a place very dear to your heart, Nepal, is kind of really in a way at the epicenter of this pandemic. So can you give me a little bit of an update? Like, how is it going there? Because I'm hearing it just through little clips here and there.
Well, I mean, they've had a terrible time in Nepal. I mean, as everyone heard, there was this huge second wave of a new variant in India. It has moved through that vast country with terrible effect. And of course, not surprisingly, it's gone north through the very porous border into Nepal and into the Himalayas. And places like Kathmandu have been very badly affected. Perhaps to illustrate that, I can tell you that our accountant at our foundation office in Kathmandu, his family has been absolutely devastated by it. Bawin's mother has died shortly thereafter. His 34-year-old cousin, so a young man, he died, and his father-in-law's sister. So it's for one family, it's been a terrible, terrible tragedy.
That's your family. Ultimately, you've had a lifetime investing yourself and your time and your energy in that part of the world. And that's what I would love to ask you about today. And, you know, I think I had told you when I met you in 2016 that I had the opportunity to interview your dad in 2004, I believe it was, at the 100th anniversary of the Explorers Club. And everybody who meets your dad, well, I can't say everybody, but most people will probably want to say, what was it like to be the first person on the top of Mount Everest? To be honest, I had no interest in that. I did. I mean, of course, that set him apart of every human being in the world. I was interested in asking him about giving back. Like his legacy, sure, he tagged it. He did brave, brilliant thing to get to the top of that mountain with Tenzing. He gave back. And it started with responding to someone say, I need a school in my village. And he thought that was going to be just one act and then a lifetime. You could have gone hitchhiking around the world and been a hippie and been happy, but you carried on the legacy. That says something. He somehow put that into you and your family. That must have been a remarkable thing to grow up in that atmosphere.
Oh, look, it was. And Dad was very inclusive of his family and his friends in all of these projects. We felt a part of it. But that was part of the magic of it, because it was actually the local people who wanted a school for their children felt a part of it too. They were, you know, it's not as if we would come in and say, well, you need education. It's them going, we want education. How can we work together to make this happen? It was a very collaborative affair. And look, the friendship, the warmth, the connection that was engendered through all of these projects really was the great thing about it. So it wasn't like drawing blood out of a stone, it really was a shared involvement and a very heartwarming one.
I'm not sure if I remember this from speaking with you, but you somewhere I saw this about remembering being a young child or maybe in your early teens riding your bike around Kathmandu before there were even car, like there might have been one or two cars in the entire city, which is that's almost an impossible thing to imagine these days. That must have, so it was pure, like the birds, it was like being in a jungle probably.
Look, it was extraordinary. Back in 1962, of course, I was only 7 years old, but our mother let us go riding our bikes. We were staying at the British ambassador's residence, and she would let us ride bikes on the street because there, apart from holy cows, other bicycles, and people carrying loads on a tub strap, the only people who had cars was the king, the American ambassador, and the British ambassador. So I think she felt that, the odds on the streets were pretty much in our favor.
Right. Watch out for those Hillary kids. They're pretty speedy on their bicycles. That's really a beautiful thing to try to imagine, because we all know, well, even the people who have never been there are well aware just what the kind of the scene of Kathmandu is. Now, I'm not talking during COVID because it got very much shut down, but things grew in the city, and then likewise the tourism and the traffic up in the Everest region has increased, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to reach out to you. And it's a good thing. The people have benefited greatly from this infusion of outsiders. And how is the environment there? My guess is that it might be better in some ways, more trees, more reforestation. They don't cut trees down to burn, things like that. But in the Everest Khumbu region, what's the state there? Is it really the highest garbage dump in the world that outsiders seem to say?
Yeah, look, I think the garbage dump stories really have got wildly overstated. I mean, certainly there was a period on the outskirts of villages or up near the base camp, there was rubbish lying around. That is true. But that has been cleaned up very, very substantially. It was cleaned up initially by foreign groups. I know my old friend Brent Bishop from Seattle had a group who went up there and removed a lot of rubbish from base camp and up from higher up on the mountain. There have been a number of efforts along those lines. But now the Sagarmatha Pollution Control Committee, based in Namche Bazaar, obviously the local people run this, and they've set up rubbish collection sites along the trails. They clear these. So they are developing the infrastructure. So it really is not so much of a problem anymore. I mean, obviously, more needs to be done. It needs to be done in all of our cities too. But I think a lot of that has been well addressed. There's a continuing problem up on the mountain. And I think really on Mount Everest, they need to take some of the bold steps that were taken, for example, on Denali. And the National Park Service came in with what when I went there, they said, look, we admit this is a very simple solution. You collect your own business in a little bag and you dispose of it only in the place that we say you can. But it really works. And I was delighted when I was up there on that amazing Alaskan mountain to find it absolutely pristine. Now, Denali did have the same human waste pollution issues that Everest did. I mean, there are something like 1,500 people climb the mountain each year. So simple mathematics tells you it could have been pretty nasty. And but these days, it's fantastic. And, the result is wonderful. But this needs to happen in Nepal. It's perhaps a little more challenging because there are cultural issues around human waste, but let's face it, we all have to take care of our business, don't we? And that's just a reality. No point getting squeamish about it. And, you know, if you go prepared with the appropriate little containers and have a protocol system, then this can be done. So that's the challenge.
Everybody knows about Mount Everest in the world, and that's one of the greatest things about it. You can't go anywhere in the world and say Mount Everest and have people go, where is that? Well, they might say, where is it? But they know what it is. It's also one of the most difficult things about it as well, because everybody has an idea about what Everest represents to them. And some people are sharply critical, like just... It's amazing, almost angry. I saw an interview with you somewhere along the line. And you said, look, it's not really our decision to make to try to lecture Nepal on how to handle this or something on that. And you used Chamonix as an example. And I loved that. Could you explain that? Because everybody's trying to get their morals and place their morals on this mountain and these people. And that's disturbing to me sometimes.
Oh, look, I think that's right. I think it's incredibly important that we don't hector the Nepalese. They are managing it the way they want to manage their mountain. And look, by and large, it is working. Mostly, you know, people are talking amongst themselves at base camp. And they are structuring the ascent so that, you know, the large numbers mean that people can go on different days. But that classic photograph from 2019 was because the weather wasn't what they expected. One group delayed their departure and went the next day when another group was coming up, and you ended up with, I think it was over 200 people on that summit ridge. But there's another side as well. So that was more an aberration. But I think the key point to make to people is that this isn't every day. You know, sometimes people think every day there's a traffic jam, just as there is in my city on the summit of Mount Everest. But, of course, that's not the case. Right now on Everest, there's not even anyone on the mountain. They've gone. The mountain's deserted. And 360 days of the year, more or less, there is no one up there. It's just on those few little days when there's a window in the weather towards the end of May when people are trying to make their ascent. So that's when you can get those crowds. But look, philosophically, I think we've got to look at what do we want from these outdoor experiences, from the mountaineering experience. And I frequently find myself quoting from that wonderful book published by the mountaineers in Seattle, The Freedom of the Hills. And what does the freedom of the hills mean to people? It means you put a pack on your back and you head out into a wonderful preserve of nature. And you are free to camp over there, collect some water to drink from this creek over the side of the river there, move up onto the mountain face. You are in a free situation in a beautiful natural environment. And I think we need to resist trying to put too many of our rules and regulations on top of this experience, because so much of our lives is dictated necessarily by rules and regulations. And for us to be able to go to the mountains and enjoy that freedom, I think is a very important thing, you know, really connecting with nature.
Yeah, beautiful. Peter, so as we emerge from COVID and this pandemic, granted with Nepal still in the thick of it, what is the more immediate kind of charge going on with the foundations that you're involved with? Are people getting in there giving assistance? Are we still waiting back? So what's kind of the next maybe 6 months or so?
Well, I think we've got to remember that the infection rates in areas like India and Nepal and Brazil and Africa, and in fact, the rates exceed, I believe, the total for 2020. So it's not as if we're cresting over and coming out of the pandemic. Globally, this is an expanding scenario. And so we are limited in terms of charities, in terms of our ability to go there. But of course, we have this amazing video call technology. I was on a call with our people in Kathmandu just yesterday, and you know, you see them, you know where they are. We've all been there so often that those communications are working very well, and they're able to organize the delivery of personal protection equipment for people working with this pandemic. We're able to deliver testing kits and fund personnel to assist with a lot of this work in terms of isolation and treatment and so on. But look, we really are reliant on the fact that lockdowns do slow the spread of the virus. Nepal has a lockdown as we speak. Kids are working and studying remotely. We've got a young boy who we sponsor, and apparently he's going to be continuing his education for the time being online out in fairly remote villages, which is astounding to me, because up until recently you'd disappear into what we would consider remote valleys in the Himalayas, and no one would hear from you and you wouldn't hear from anyone for all of the time that you're there. But suddenly I was just speaking to this young man, and you know, at this very humble house, and look, this technology is quite remarkable, and there's a lot of good things about it. So look, the lockdown and the next big step, and of course many countries, the US, Australia, New Zealand and others, have been contributing to the delivery of vaccines to places like Nepal. And this is a very important way that we can start to get on top of this.
So for somebody who's listening to this, who might have an interest in helping in whatever way they can, be it a donation, and that might be how they do it, but what can someone do if they're inclined to lend a hand?
Well, look, I'm on the board of the American Himalayan Foundation and in San Francisco, so they could make a donation to the AHF, and that would be greatly appreciated, because there are immediate needs. Now, vaccination obviously is an important destination for every country. And let's face it, I mean, a country like the US or New Zealand or wherever you are is not really going to be safe from this disease until the Nepalese are or people in Nigeria are. We've really got to reach out to the global community. So that's important. But certainly getting PPE, testing kits, assisting with lockdown and isolation to slow this disease is incredibly important. So the support that people can give is greatly appreciated, and it's important for all of us ultimately.
Fantastic. So my gut is you haven't been on an airplane in a while. Maybe you have, but have your travel has probably been just cut down to nothing, or are you still jumping around?
Yeah, international travel. Oh, look, I haven't been out of New Zealand since March 2020, when I arrived back from Antarctica just before the lockdown. However, I've been able to travel around New Zealand extensively. So I'm on airliners pretty often. Because New Zealand is open, we have to wear a mask on a plane, but everywhere else, you go to restaurants, you gather with your friends, there are simply no issues. We've been very fortunate.
That's fantastic. So I interviewed my friend Jamie McGinnis not long ago, who I was on Everest with in 2019 in Tibet. And I guess I wasn't thinking because I said he's possibly the second greatest Kiwi mountaineer of all time. And I'm not sure how I wasn't thinking about you. I might have to bump Jamie because you were climbing Everest before Jamie was, and you did some pretty incredible things yourself. So, you know, so I'm apologizing to you because who knows, maybe Jamie would rib you if he ever bumped into you. But
look, we essentially, let's face it, we all go to the mountains for our own reasons. It's to achieve something. Sure, generally the aim is to tag the summit, a momentary, brief, rather marvelous moment to reach the top of a mountain. But it's that whole process, the people we share the experience with, and the incredible sights and experiences we have. So, I don't think we need to grade us particularly. Obviously, there are some truly great technical mountaineers who've pushed the parameters, and they do set benchmarks, but it's a very broad pursuit for why we go, what we get out of it. But there's no question, I think, for every single one of us, you get a lot out of going on an expedition. You know, you're on a very, in a way, it simplifies the world. You know, it comes back to those basic needs: shelter, warmth, bit of company, some warm food. And it really doesn't matter what sort of food. It could even be Tibetan tsampa with hot, salty tea. But if that's all that's going, that's the best food in the world because that's what you've got. And that's a kind of a nice space to be in for some of the time. And I think that's part of the attraction of being going mountaineering and the expeditionary experience.
That's fantastic. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Let me ask you this one last thing. This might be a great way to wrap it up. One of the things that you champion is not necessarily always, you know, people going to the mountains, but people overcoming their fears, having the courage to go after what's in their heart or what their desires are. And you've spoken around the world to big, huge audiences and small audiences. What do you tell people about unleashing the shackles of that hold them from going after what they really desire?
Look, I think, you know, lots of people desire to do all sorts of different things. But I think the key here is there really is no time like now. And it doesn't mean that, you know, just because someone is talking to someone like yourself or me, and you identify this person as a mountaineer, and you think, gee, I would have liked to have done that. It doesn't mean that you necessarily have to go and do that, but go and do something. It could be, you know, make some music, go for a walk in the park, build something, do something that really draws on your inner self. And it's important to get out and do that because that expression is enriching for each and every one of us. And I think it gives us the opportunity to really develop who we are and what we want to be. And certainly climbing on big mountains has done that for me. It's taken me right to the edge of, you know, my ability, my psychological and emotional strength. You know, I've found myself really pressed. But, you know, when you come back and you digest that experience, it's generally a very, very positive process. And I think you come away from it better off and proud that you went there.
Thank you so much. And have a fantastic day. You're at the dawn of a new day in New Zealand. And I do appreciate it. So thanks for everything.
Thanks, Tom.
Today, there are Himalayan foundations in 6 countries, and Peter is a board member, fundraiser, regular Nepal visitor. He continues his commitment to helping people help themselves. Thank you, Peter, for taking the time to speak with me today. For more info on Peter and how to give to the Himalayan foundations or to inquire about a speaking engagement with Peter, visit peterhillary.com. But to know how it feels now and then, I got a happiness just And on June 30th, there will be a Facebook Live event hosted by Musa Masala to benefit the Wong Chu Memorial Hospital. Links to the event are in the show notes, or you can visit musamasala.com. As always, thank you to the Wood Brothers and their management for the use of their song Happiness Jones for our theme song here on the HQ, and to their publicist Kevin Calabro for helping make it all happen. For more information about me, Tom Dharma Pollard, to inquire about personal coaching or public speaking in person or virtually, please visit me at eyesopenproductions.com. And you can write me anytime at tom.dharma.pollard@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe and leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean a whole lot. And you can also visit me anytime at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient for a free download of A Course in Happiness. Thanks for visiting The Happiness Quotient. I will see you all real soon.
Happiness Jones, my friend. Happiness Jones.